Okay, well, I'll move on now to a couple of topics connected with realism. And this leads naturally on from some of the considerations about normativity that we encountered in the previous two lectures. First of all, I'm going to discuss realism about necessity and its opponents. According to the realist, we can simply recognize that certain statements are necessarily true, that the status of necessity attaches to certain truths, centrally logical, mathematical truths. And sometimes this is embellished by talk of a special cognitive faculty. So just as we're endowed with a perceptual faculty for recognizing the layout of empirical reality, so also the idea is, according to the realist, that we have a special cognitive faculty which enables us to detect necessity. And this idea of a special cognitive faculty has, of course, been attacked as a piece of mythology by various opponents of realism. For example, the later Wittgenstein, in some of his remarks on the foundations of mathematics, clearly thinks of the process of conducting mathematical and logical proof not as a way of discovering a special sort of fact, but as a special way of discovering an ordinary sort of fact, you might say. And sometimes he talks in terms of a decision to treat an ordinary empirical truth as a necessary truth. One gets a sense in some of his writings that he thinks all truths are in origin contingent, empirical, but some of these get jumped up by a kind of community decision to the status of a necessary truth. That kind of thinking about necessity goes under the label conventionalism, so the idea that necessity is a matter of convention. What we treat as necessary truths are things that we decide or in some way agree by convention to treat as such. The convention being usually, of course, of a tacit nature rather than an explicit nature. There's an interesting argument that is discussed by Edward Craig and Crispin Wright in some of their publications, to the effect that in committing ourselves to the necessity of an arithmetical truth, say 7 plus 5 equals 12, we're going beyond what is strictly warranted by the facts, and that we can imagine a community which acknowledges everything a realist takes to justify the assertion that 7 plus 5 equals 12, but which doesn't promote that to the status of a necessary truth. And the label that is attached to this community is that it is cautious. And we might contrast that, for the sake of having a convenient label, we might say a community such as ours plausibly is, which does take that arithmetical truth to be a necessity, we might call that a confident community. So the difference between a cautious and a confident community is this: they both recognize the same set of arithmetical facts and logical facts, mathematical facts, logical facts in general. But whereas the cautious community regards these simply as facts and doesn't want to go any further than that, it's simply true that 7 plus 5 equals 12, the confident community wants to go further and say not merely is it true, it's also necessary. There's no other possibility than that 7 plus 5 should equal 12. Whereas, as I say, the cautious community isn't willing to go that far. But as far as their practice goes, both communities match in their logical and mathematical practice. And indeed, not only do the members of this cautious community regard 7 plus 5 equals 12 as true, they're even prepared to concede that you can't imagine, or they can't imagine, anything else. So the negation of that would be unimaginable. It's unimaginable, they concede, that 7 plus 5 should not be 12. But they reject the move from unimaginability to impossibility. So in other words, although they agree that you can't imagine anything other than 7 plus 5 equaling 12, they're not prepared to go as far as saying that it's simply inconceivable or simply impossible that 7 plus 5 should equal something else. They want to be cautious about that and say, well, we can't imagine alternatives, but we don't want to conclude from that that there really are no alternatives, that an alternative would be impossible. Putting it another way, they're not prepared to advance from a statement about our particular psychological makeup, or their particular psychological makeup. You know, we and they can't imagine an alternative to that arithmetical truth. So that's a fact about psychology. It's a fact about how you are fitted up to think of things. And they don't want to conclude from that to the way things are in reality. They don't want to move from saying that you can't imagine an alternative to saying, well, an alternative would be impossible. So statements about our mental limitations have no implications, according to this line of thought, for reality, for how things are in reality. And as I said before, we're to assume that the members of this cautious community are operationally competent. That's to say, we can't fault their logical and mathematical practice. And we can assume for these purposes that their logical and mathematical practice is indistinguishable from ours, is indistinguishable from a confident community's practice. It's just that they accord a different status to the truths that they uncover when they do logic and mathematics from the status that we accord those truths, or that a confident community accords those truths. Well, if the hypothesis of a cautious community is coherent, what does it show? And here we face a dilemma, I think. One possibility is that it shows that the realists claim that we possess a special cognitive faculty, which is sensitive to necessity, that that claim is empty. And the thought here would be that since the cautious community can do without that claim, it has no need of the realist's claim. It simply gets along with the truth of 7 plus 5 equals 12. It doesn't advance from that to its necessity. And since by hypothesis that doesn't hinder its members from being operationally competent, as we've said, we should agree that they have acknowledged all the facts, so that they are responding to everything there is in the world in treating these arithmetical truths as truths. They're not missing out on anything in refusing to advance to asserting necessity. And if that's the right way to describe the situation, then it would indeed seem that the extramodal status of these arithmetical truths that we're focusing on, that is championed by the realist and by the confident community, that extra status is revealed then as an illusion. If the cautious community really do see all there is to see and respond to all the facts there are to respond to, then there's no point in going further and larding those facts with an extra status that in reality they simply don't have. So that's one possibility. But the other possibility raised by the assumption that the practices of these two communities, cautious and confident, match, is that it's the other way round, and that it's the cautious attitude that is really something of a sham, rather than the confident attitude that goes too far. And the thought here would be that, despite their non-committal utterances, the members of the cautious community are in fact committed to the necessity of arithmetical truths by their practice. The idea here would be that they have the relevant cognitive faculty is simply shown by their flawless participation in the practice. That's all it takes. If you conduct your logical and mathematical operations competently, then that simply shows that, according to the realist, you have the relevant cognitive faculty, that you are detecting necessities in the world. And this latter possibility is sometimes ignored in discussions of the problem that is posed by the cautious attitude. Crispin Wright, for example, simply assumes that if we have a match in practice between the cautious and the confident communities, and let's say we suppose that the cautious people can be trained to match the confident ones, not only in their practices, but also in their utterances about those practices, so they recognize when the confident community are going to go further and say that this is not merely true, but it's necessarily true. They recognize, they're able to detect those scenarios. And then if they want, they can match their own language to that, even though they don't themselves believe that these truths really are necessary. They think that's an unwarranted extra. They can nevertheless detect when the confident people are going to believe that. And so if they want, they can match their own utterances to that. And as it were, talk with the confident people as though they really thought that these arithmetical and logical truths were necessary, even though that is not something they themselves subscribe to. And Crispin Wright's view is that if that all makes sense, then what that shows is that, as he says, the whole hypothesis of the cognitive faculty is seen to be empty. And he says that on the basis that nothing distinguishes the operations of the two different communities that I've been imagining. So that he takes the view that the confident people, the ones who are describing the practice as more elaborately, who are going further in their descriptions of what's really happening, namely they're saying, well, we've got this special cognitive faculty and we're responsive to, we're able to detect necessity in the world. The fact that the cautious community can match their practices, can do as much as they can, they're just as good at maths and logic as the confident people, it's just that they don't grace the truths they arrive at with the status of being necessary, but their practices are up to scratch, so to speak. Then Wright thinks, well, that just shows that the extra cognitive faculty is unnecessary. The hypothesis that we or the confident people have it is empty, as he says. That comes on page 457 of his book, Wittgenstein on the Foundations of Mathematics. And if we or the confident community make the move, as we do and they do, of saying, well, these truths are not merely true, they're also necessarily true, then, says Wright, what's happening there is that an extra decision is being made to accept these statements as necessarily true. An extra decision that isn't required by conformity to the practice. So you can do logic, you can do mathematics perfectly satisfactorily if you're cautious, if you don't recognize the necessity of the truths that you arrive at. You just take them to be true, merely true, not necessarily true. And of course, I've been describing it in such a way as to make Wright's view sound plausible. But the way I've already set up the dilemma shows that he's missing out one possibility. He's missing out half of the dilemma, because the fact that the two practices match in the way they do, the confident and the cautious practices, doesn't necessarily show that it's the confident people who are adding an unnecessary extra twiddle to their description of what's going on. that cautious description is perfectly satisfactory and nothing more needs to be said. No, it could show the opposite, that it's the cautious people who are wrong in their description of the scenario, that in fact, as I was hinting a moment ago, and this is what the realists would say to them, look, your practice with these logical and mathematical truths just shows that you do, in fact, whatever you may think you're doing, you do, in fact, recognize their necessity. You do, in fact, have the special cognitive faculty because you're behaving in the right way, and that's all it takes to have that faculty. And this is really a Wittgensteinian point that is coming in here, that there's an essential connection between mind and behavior, and that to be minded in a certain way is not a matter of introspection, introspective phenomenology. It's a matter of how you behave. So that if you behave in the right way, that just shows you you've got a certain faculty. The test for whether you have that cognitive faculty is not whether you can introspect and sort of discern something in yourself with a distinctive phenomenology. That would be a Cartesian approach to it. And I think Wright is to some extent presupposing that sort of approach. But a Wittgensteinian would say, well, no, that's not the kind of thing that a mental faculty is. It's not necessarily open to introspection at all. Whether you've got it or not is a matter of how you behave. And if these cautious people are behaving in the right way, then the realist will simply say that just shows that whatever they may think of the matter, they've got this special cognitive faculty and they're responding to and detecting necessity in re in the world. So to summarise, the position we've reached is this. You've got two communities we're imagining, a confident and a cautious community. They entirely agree in their practices with logical and mathematical and other necessary truths. They regard the same things as being true. Both communities conduct mathematical proofs, say, in exactly the same way. They arrive at exactly the same set of truths. So as far as the truth of necessary truths go, they agree. They treat the same things as having that status as true. What they disagree about is whether those things are also necessary. And the cautious community says, no, they're not necessary. We may not be able to imagine alternatives, but we don't want to go as far as saying that they're actually necessary. It may be that alternatives to them are possible, even though we can't imagine them. So we'll just stick at saying that they're true. 7 plus 5 equals 12 is true, we'll say. We won't say it's necessarily true. Whereas the confident community do go further and say, yes, it's necessarily true. Not only can we not imagine an alternative to that, but an alternative is inconceivable and impossible in reality. So that the thing has the status of a necessary truth, not merely the status of a truth. So that was the situation we set up, and then we raised a dilemma, which is that if that's all coherent so far, if we can set up these two communities and that all makes sense, then what does that show about the realism-conventionalism debate? Does it show that either side wins? And I suggested that it doesn't. The situation is still indeterminate as between two options. One of them is that the cautious community recognize all the facts, and that in going beyond those facts, the confident community are adding an unnecessary rhetorical extra, if you like. When they say such and such is necessary, all they really mean is, or all they're really entitled to mean at any rate, is, well, we can't really get our heads around any alternative. We can't really imagine any alternative. The cautious community, of course, agree with that. But as far as the sheer facts go, as far as the sheer state of affairs in the world goes, the cautious community recognize everything there is to be recognized. So one option is therefore that in going further than that, the confident community are going beyond what is strictly warranted by the facts, and the realists claim therefore that they have some kind of special insight into reality, some cognitive faculty that detects necessity. That claim falls. That claim would be revealed as illusory. If necessity isn't in the facts, then they can't be detecting that necessity in there. They don't have this special cognitive faculty. The best we can say for them is that they've made a decision of a certain sort. They've adopted a policy to speak in this way about certain truths. So that's one way out of the dilemma. But the other way, which I was stressing, because it's, as I said, it's sometimes ignored, is that the argument goes in the opposite direction, that it's the realist who wins, because the cautious hypothesis is revealed to be a sham. Although people can talk in that way, you can say, if you like, well, look, I'm going to treat 7 plus 5 equals 12 as merely true, not as necessarily true. You can say that if you like. You can come out with those words. But the thought is you can't really mean them. You can't really put life into them. As long as your behaviour matches that of the confident community, then from this point of view, the confident community's description of what's going on will apply to your behaviour as well as to theirs. In other words, you are shown to have the special cognitive faculty by virtue of the fact that you exhibit the right kind of behaviour. That's just what it is to have that special cognitive faculty, to behave in the appropriate way. And since, by hypothesis, the cautious community does behave in that appropriate way, it's operationally competent in all the relevant respects, that just shows that it's got the special cognitive faculty. It satisfies the criterion for that. Whether or not you have this faculty, as I said, is not a matter for individual or even community introspection. It's not a first personal matter at all, to put it in those terms. It's a third personal matter. It's a matter of how your behaviour is objectively correctly described. What it feels like, say, what kind of phenomenology it has to think about truths like 7 plus 5 equals 12, whether you get a sort of a different feeling when you think about that kind of truth than you do when you think about an ordinary empirical truth like the cat is on the mat, that's neither here nor there. What matters is your behaviour. And as I say, since the realist way out of the dilemma would be to say, well, since the cautious community matches in all relevant respects the behaviour of the confident community, then it's their caution that is a sham rather than the confidence of the confident community. They're being too cautious, or they're purporting to be cautious, whereas in reality they're just in the same situation as everyone else, as the confident people. They're expressing a caution which isn't justified by the facts. And, that's a commonly observed phenomenon. Just as people can be overconfident, they can be overcautious in the way they express themselves. So there are two ways out of the dilemma, as you would expect. I mean, if in any other situation, if two people are giving an assessment of the situation and one gives a very cautious assessment and the other one gives a very bullish, confident assessment, well, there are two possibilities. The cautious assessment might be right and the confident person might be going too far, but it might be the other way around. So we have to reckon with both of those possibilities. And of course, in purely objective terms, it's just as much a fault to underestimate as it is to overestimate. They're both mistakes. So in effect, the problem posed by the dilemma is, what is the right description of our practice that involves necessity, and in particular, logical and mathematical practice? Well, if the hypothesis of a special cognitive faculty is indeed empty, as Wright wants to say, then in going beyond the sheer contingency of a statement like 7 plus 5 equals 12, the confident community would be adopting a policy, as Wright also says. Or we could say that it adopts a convention. So this is where the conventionalist view hooks onto the discussion. The cautious community doesn't adopt a particular convention, which the confident community does. And the realist approach will still be mistaken on this line, but the mistake that the confident community makes is not so much that it adopts the convention, it's free to do that, but rather that it has a wrong attitude towards that convention. It thinks that it's mandatory to behave in the way it does, whereas in fact it isn't. It thinks it has no choice. Well, maybe it has no practical choice in the sense that it can't imagine a different way of doing things and wouldn't be comfortable with a different way of doing things. But as we said before, on the conventionalist line, it doesn't follow from that that an alternative is logically impossible. It just follows that we have rather limited imaginations. So conventionalism, you could say, is the view that the cautious description of our scenario is the right one, and that if you go any further than the cautious community goes, then you are adopting a convention rather than responding to a necessity in the nature of things. Now, as I mentioned, one of the people who's written on this topic is Edward Craig, and he's written two very illuminating papers on the issue. And in the earlier paper, which is called The Problem of Necessary Truth, published in a collection edited by Simon Blackburn called Meaning, Reference and Necessity, in the earlier paper, Craig represents the dispute between the realist and the conventionalist as turning on the relative priority of word meaning over sentence meaning. So this is an issue that we've met before. And according to this line of thought, the realist about necessity thinks that a necessary truth is true and necessary in virtue of the meanings of its component words and the syntax of the sentence. Given these, its necessity just pops out, as it were, as an automatic upshot. Whereas the conventionalist thinks that once we've fixed word meaning and syntax, there still remains to be settled the question whether the truth in question is necessary. So once we've fixed the meanings of all the component words in our arithmetical statement, 7 plus 5 equals 12, and we've fixed the syntax of English, that does not yet settle whether that statement is necessary. Another way to think about the conventionalist position is to say, well, the adopting of a convention to regard a truth like 7 plus 5 equals 12 as necessary, that actually in part fixes the meanings of the component words. So this conventionalist claim would be that you don't fix the meanings of the component words in any real sense in advance of determining sentences like that, 7 plus 5 equals 12, to be necessary. That's all part of the process, as it were, of fixing the meanings of the component words. So we have a situation rather similar to the one we had before with forwards and reverse compositionality. The meaning of a word like 7 not merely contributes to the meaning of a sentence like 7 plus 5 equals 12, it's also partly itself determined by the necessary status of that sentence. So the conventionalist on this line would say something like, when the realist says that necessity pops out, as it were, as an automatic upshot from the meanings of the words and the way they're put together in the sentence, you have the meanings of the words, you have the syntax of English, you put those together and you get a sentence like 7 plus 5 equals 12, and then says the realist, oh, and the necessity of that sentence comes, as it were, for free as an extra. The conventionalist would respond, well, actually, the necessity that you say pops out at that point is necessity that you've already put in there by your decision to regard that statement as necessary. You've made that as a policy decision. That has in turn influenced the meanings of the individual words. So they've already got built into them as part of their meanings the consequence, if you like, that when they're put together in this particular way, a necessity will be outputted. So the necessity doesn't come as a surprise, as an add-on extra, when you put the words together in this way. It's already built into the meanings of the words from the beginning that they will have that kind of consequence. The word meanings and the necessity of the truths that they go to form are being fixed together according to this conventionalist line of thought. But it's a conventionalism because it's still a matter of decision. It's still regarded as a matter of policy or decision to which alternatives are logically possible. Now, I said that on this conventionalist view, the meanings of component words would be in part fixed by decisions as to which sentences to regard as necessarily true. So I said that, you know, the decision on this conventionalist line, the decision to regard 7 plus 5 equals 12 as necessarily true, that goes some way towards determining, that influences the meanings of the component words, that decision. But it's only in part because at least it's plausible to think that the meanings of numerals like 7 and 5 are also, at least partly, dependent on the way they connect up in perceptual sentences. I mean, these words are used to report experiences. There are five horses in the field, for example. I've got seven books on the table. We don't seem to be talking about necessary truths at all, but we're still using these numerical terms. And it seems to be an essential part of their meaning that they can figure in such sentences. So that is also going to affect their meaning. It's not just going to be the fact that they can figure in arithmetical statements. So there are perceptual criteria of application for these words, as well as arithmetical ones. And this is a point that was famously brought out by Dummett in a paper of his on Wittgenstein's philosophy of mathematics, where he imagined a scenario where we were counting seven boys and five girls, and we want to know how many children there are in all. And he said, well, there are two ways of finding that out. You can either count the lot, as it were, all in one go, or, having counted the seven boys and the five girls, you can do a bit of arithmetic and work out that there must be 12 in all. Now, for the realist, these two different ways will necessarily coincide, because the realist regards the truth that 7 plus 5 equals 12 as part of reality, as something that's written into the structure of reality. It's a necessity out there. So that if you perform that addition, and if you perform it correctly, you must get the answer 12. Whichever method you're pursuing, whether you're using arithmetic to calculate the sum of 7 plus 5, or using observation to count two groups, one of 7 and one of 5, and then count the lot altogether, whichever of those methods you're using, you will necessarily reach the same answer if you're doing it correctly. That's what the realist will say. But according to the conventionalist, the decision to treat 7 plus 5 equals 12 as a necessary truth, and that is a matter of decision, remember, a matter of policy on the conventionalist's view, that's essentially a new move which isn't mandated by anything else. And so in particular, it's not mandated by any kind of adherence to perceptual criteria involved in counting. So, for the conventionalists, the two methods can come apart. They are essentially different methods. They don't necessarily coincide. If you count all of the children, that gives you one result. If you perform the arithmetical sum, that gives you a result. But the arithmetical calculation depends ultimately on a matter of community decision. And the community could have decided a different way. So there's no guarantee in the nature of things that these two processes are going to reach the same result, even if they're both carried out correctly. That's a crucial proviso, of course, is there's no guarantee anyway that counting is going to be correctly carried out, or that people are going to perform arithmetical sums correctly. But the point for the conventionalist is that, to put it in concrete terms, we might have decided to adopt the convention that 7 plus 5 equals 13, right? That was an option in the initial position, as it were. And then that would have been the answer to the sum. So if we counted the children, if we pursued the other method and counted the children all together, and suppose we get 12, then in that situation we would judge that we must have made a mistake, because the result does not accord with our arithmetic. And we would have to posit some kind of mistake, such as oversight, or one of the children has disappeared during the counting process or something like that. For the conventionalist, if we say that the counting operation that yields 12, say, is wrong, that's because we're adopting a new and essentially independent criterion of correctness. So we're in this situation I'm imagining, this alternative scenario, a community is laying it down that 7 plus 5 equals 13. That's the arithmetic that it's supposedly adopting. If it then has two groups of children, 7 boys and 5 girls, and it counts them all together and gets the answer 12, as we would expect, then it will judge that it has made an operational mistake of some sort. And so it is using its decision to adopt that arithmetic as a criterion of correctness, as a criterion that enables it to judge when a perceptual mistake has been made in ordinary counting. Right, and in doing that, it's just, you know, I've just set up a mirror image of what we would do. You know, if you've got a bunch of boys and you count them, there are 7. And you've got a bunch of girls, you count them, there are 5. You say, all right, well, there must be 12 children in all. That's, I've just done the arithmetic. If you then actually go through them and count them one by one, you number them off, and you get 11 or 13 as your answer, you will say, well, I must have made a mistake. Something's happened. There's been an operational hiccup here. So this alternative community is, in general terms, just doing exactly the same as what any community would do and what we would do in that situation, namely use its arithmetic as a means of deciding whether counting operations have been correctly conducted or not. Those operations must agree with the arithmetic, and if they don't, then we will judge that a mistake has been made, even if we can't find it. Right? Then we will simply say, well, it must have been some kind of a very subtle mistake, or nobody was looking at the time, but something untoward has happened to put off the counters, and that's why the mistake has been made. Now, Craig argues that conventionalism fails, and he does so on the basis of the following sort of consideration. This is in his first paper. He says, well, let's look at a really simple example. So let's take something like 1 plus 1 equals 2, an even simpler arithmetical sum than the one that we've been using as an illustration so far. Suppose we have the similar sort of Dummett situation in which we're counting two groups. Each group has got one individual in it. And the question is what we can arrive at by our different methods of calculating 1 plus 1. And the conventionalist, according to Craig's argument, has got to be prepared to say something like, in the initial position, so before we've, as it were, adopted a convention, suppose we haven't yet decided what convention to adopt about the sum of 1 plus 1. There are various possibilities, there are various alternatives that are open to us in that situation. And if, in advance of deciding on a particular arithmetic, we actually go through the counting process and are having counted the two different groups and found that there's one individual in each, we then count the lot, as it were, we put them together and count them as a single group. If we arrive, say, at the answer 3, there's nothing so far for the conventionalist to tell us that we've made a mistake. We haven't yet adopted an arithmetic which would rule on whether that result was impossible or not. And we're not guaranteed to be able to find a perceptual error. We may find that an error was made by purely perceptual criteria, as it were. We may find that we double counted. But we may not. We may decide that the operational criteria were satisfied, the counting process was satisfactorily conducted, the result achieved was 3, and as far as anything that's happened so far goes, that can be the right answer. What would make that the wrong answer would be if we then adopted the convention, according to the conventionalist, of saying, well, 1 plus 1 equals 2, that's what we're going to say in our arithmetic. So if we count 1 plus 1 in an ordinary situation where we put the two groups together and then count the lot, and we arrive at any answer other than 2, then we must have made a mistake. Even if we can't detect it, our arithmetic tells us that we must have made a mistake. But of course, if we adopt an alternative arithmetic in which we say 1 plus 1 is 3, then we will judge that in the situation where we count the lot and get three, we haven't made a mistake. And if you counted the lot and got two, then in that situation, you'd be judged to have made a mistake. And the conventionalists would say, well, it doesn't matter whether you can detect it or not. It might be an undetectable error, but there must have been some error because the arithmetic tells us, and this is a convention we're adopting, that 1 plus 1 equals 3. Okay, that's the position as Craig sets it up. That's what he thinks a conventionalist has to say. And then his response is, well, that's just implausible. And the simpler you make the example, the more implausible it looks. And that's why he goes to a really simple example like 1 plus 1 equals 2. I mean, he also considers, you know, even lower sums than that involving 0, but we'll stick to 1 plus 1 equals 2. And he says, well, if there are two groups, one containing one object and one the other containing one object, and you count them together, you count them all together, and you arrive at an answer other than 2, then you must have made some operational mistake. And that's, as it were, already true before you've adopted any arithmetic. Or at least that's how you would have to put it if you were talking with the conventionalist. So if you're going along with the conventionalist way of thinking that it's a matter of decision or policy what arithmetic you adopt, then Craig's response is, well, but before you've adopted any policy, it's already true by purely operational criteria that you must get 2 as the answer when you have two lots of one object and you count them all together. And if you don't get that, then there will be some operational error, some perceptual error that you can detect. If you watch a film of the whole proceeding, you'll be able to see that you've double counted or that there's been interference from outside, or something's disappeared under your nose, something like that. There'll be some error that is in principle detectable if you go on looking for it long enough. So Craig is saying, well, look, if you've got two groups of one object each and then you count them all together and you get 3, you've already made some mistake before the question of a correct arithmetic has been broached. Whereas the conventionalist is obliged to say, before that question has been broached, we've got no criterion for whether you've made a mistake or not. And if we settle on the convention that 1 plus 1 equals 3, then we'll say you haven't made a mistake. Or if you have made a mistake, you will have made another compensating mistake, so that you nevertheless have arrived at the right answer. Of course, if you count up objects and you get the right answer, that's not a guarantee that you haven't made a mistake. But we normally think that it is a guarantee that if you've made some mistake somewhere, you've made a compensating mistake which cancelled out the first mistake. Okay, but anyway, the point is that the conventionalist is obliged to say, well, look, if we adopt the convention that 1 plus 1 equals 3, and we can adopt that convention, then if you go through that counting operation and you get 3 as your answer, you've got it right. Full stop. Whereas Craig wants to say, well, that's just very counterintuitive. We naturally want to respond to that by saying, no, if you have one object and one object, you put them together and you count the lot and you get 3 as your answer, then you've made an operational error, quite regardless of arithmetical considerations, if you like. I mean, that's a slightly inaccurate way of putting it, of course, because, as I said earlier, the realist thinks that operational criteria in counting operations and arithmetical criteria necessarily coincide. So for the realist, there isn't this sort of stage before which you've adopted an arithmetic. Already at any stage at all at which you're counting, you've got some kind of implicit arithmetic going. That's what a realist will say. It's the conventionalist who's attempting to split up the two procedures in this way and treat them as logically independent. For the realist, they're logically coincident. So basically, Craig's criticism in the earlier paper is that the conventionalist is obliged to allow for a scenario, to make sense of a scenario, which really doesn't make sense. That's to say, one in which you have, for example, two groups, each group containing one object. You put them together, you count them all up, you get 3 as your answer, and that is the correct answer, because that's the arithmetic that you've adopted. According to the convention that you've adopted in arithmetic, 1 plus 1 equals 3, so you've arrived at the correct answer. And so either you've made no mistake at all in your counting, or if you have made a mistake, it's been compensated for. Whereas what Craig wants to say, to put it in a nutshell, is that you will have made an uncompensated error in your counting. We will in principle be able to detect a mistake that you've made not compensated for by another mistake, which meant that you arrived at the wrong answer, 3, as opposed to the correct answer, 2. Now, in the later paper, Craig is more hospitable to conventionalism than he was in the earlier paper. He continues to think that the kind of conventionalism that he was arguing against in the earlier paper is unsustainable, but he now thinks that it's possible to have another form of conventionalism which survives his earlier criticisms. And essentially this form is one that often goes under the name projectivism, and the idea is that necessity is something that we project onto reality as onto a screen. And here Craig says, well, we don't have to be contingentists about this form of projection. We don't have to think that alternatives are possible. But we nevertheless take a non-cognitivist approach to necessity. That's to say, we treat necessity as something that is not in reality as something to be discovered and cognized by, as we were saying before, this special cognitive faculty, but is rather something that we project into reality. And maybe that in a sense we have no choice about that projection. It may be that that's the way it has to be in some sense, but it is nevertheless an addition to what's in the world. That's the idea. And the model for the projection is essentially a causal one. So the idea is that we are caused to make the projections that we do make. Reality is a certain way. It's a empirical reality is causally set up in a certain way. We interact with it. And one of its causal effects on us is that we make certain projections. We see the world in certain ways. We're caused to do this. And one of the ways in which we make projections is that we modalize reality. We see reality in modal terms. We don't merely think that there are facts out there. We think there are necessary facts out there as well. It's not merely that things are a certain way, it's that they have to be that way. And that is an extra, according to this line of thought, that we are projecting onto reality. We're caused to do so. So the idea is essentially to naturalize necessity in a sort of Humean way, to say, well, there's nothing mysterious about necessity if we think of it in this way. Seeing things as necessary is a product of the way we are and the way we causally interact with the world. But there's a good sense in which necessity is not really there in reality, according to this line of thinking, so that the realist is wrong about that claim. The realist who wants to say, well, look, you know, there are tables and chairs out there, there are numbers out there, and there are necessities out there. There are not merely ways things are, there are ways they have to be and ways they can't be. And these are written into the nature of reality, and there's nothing we can do about them. And they're not of our making. They're not a product in any sense of our activity, our cultural or linguistic activity. Now, that's the realist line. And so the projectivist image is supposed to be avoiding that kind of realism, but at the same time acknowledging that we do tend to see things in a certain way, and we do tend to think of reality in modal terms, not merely simple factual terms. We do tend to think of reality as, in certain respects, having to be a certain way, not merely being that way. You know, so we find it natural to think that 7 plus 5 just has to equal 12. There's no other possibility. That's a very natural thought. And the projectivist image then, as it were, comes to the rescue, according to this conventionalist line of thought, in giving us a model for understanding what's going on here without having to commit ourselves to what the realist wants to say, namely that there is actually necessity in the nature of things. Now, as I say, Craig in the later article is quite friendly towards this form of projectivism, but it seems to me to be unsatisfactory. And that is because it's occupying an awkward halfway house, and you can push it a bit and see which way it goes. I mean, if these projections really are contingent, if there are alternative projections that are at least logically possible, if there are different ways of seeing reality either seeing different necessities out there, or like the cautious community that we had before, not seeing any necessities at all, not making any projections at all of that sort. If these are genuine, at least logical possibilities, then we seem to be back with the old contingency of 7 plus 5 equals 12. We may see that as necessary, but the conventionalist projectivist will be obliged to say that underneath it's not really necessary. That's actually a mistake on our part. It isn't genuinely necessary. We're simply recording limitations to our imagination when we say that it has to be that way. All we really are entitled to mean, as I said much earlier, is we can't imagine any other way it might be. Our imaginations are limited. But we shouldn't conclude from that that things couldn't be some other way. So, I mean, if you take the image of projection seriously, if you think of it in terms, in terms of an actual physical projector of the sort that we're familiar with a screen and with an image being projected onto the screen, then you have to say, I think, well, the thing that is projected onto the screen really is projected. It's not there in reality. I mean, that's indeed part of what the conventionalist does want to say in response to the realist. The necessity is not actually there in reality. It's projected onto it by us, and then we see it after having put it there and see it as though it's there, but we're in fact responsible for having put it there. But if the whole process, if the whole transaction is a contingent one, if there are alternative projections that are possible, then in seeing the necessity in reality and treating it as really necessary, we're making a mistake. These things are not really necessary. They are underneath. They are contingencies. Alternative things, alternative truths could have been necessary truths, maybe no truths at all, as the cautious community says. We might not have made any modal projections at all, as I said earlier. So I think if you're taking the image of projection seriously, then you have to say that it's not really an advance on where we were before. We still have to, on the conventionalist picture, we still have to make sense of the possibility that, there could be alternatives, alternative ways of doing things, so that 7 plus 5 equals 12 is not absolutely necessary. Even if we have difficulty or can't imagine it, we have to at least reckon with the possibility that there could be alternative conventions in which 7 plus 5 equals 13. I mean, that's after all what you'd expect from the label conventionalism. If it really is a convention, then surely, you might say, it's inherent in the nature of a convention that alternatives to it are possible. I mean, that's obvious from the simplest examples one might think of conventions. I mean, what's a convention? Well, it's something like driving on the right-hand side or the left-hand side of the road. That's a convention. A country has to adopt one of those conventions. It doesn't matter which one, it's arbitrary, but it has to adopt one of them and everyone has to do the same thing. But it's a genuine convention in the sense that, as I've said, whichever one it adopts, it could equally well have adopted the other one. There's nothing in reality forcing you to say, well, people must drive on the left. It doesn't matter which way you do it, and reality, as it were, has got an open mind on the question. So that's a genuine convention, and that's what we're all convention. We're all conventionalists about which side of the road one drives on. But when it comes to whether 7 plus 5 equals 12 or not, that seems to be another matter. We're not all conventionalists about that. And to say, well, that's a matter of convention too, does seem to carry the implication that 7 plus 5 might not have equaled 12. And even if we can't or have difficulty imagining that, nevertheless, it's got to be in some sense possible that 7 plus 5 didn't equal 12. And I'm suggesting that the image of projection doesn't really help you make sense of that conventionalist move, because projection seems to be underneath a contingent transaction. So that, you still have to say, well, alternative projections would have been possible. Alternative projections to the ones we make. No projection at all would have been a possibility. So that you're still confronted with the fact that it really is a matter of arbitrary convention on this view, that 7 plus 5 equals 12, and alternatives to that were conceivable, are conceivable, or rather, depending on how one wants to use the word conceivable, they're at least logically possible. They've got to be logically possible on this view if it's to count as a genuine form of conventionalism. If, on the other hand, we say that the projecting isn't a contingent transaction, that there aren't alternatives to it. I mean, for one thing, as I've said, that really seems to me to conflict with the whole idea of projection. Because if there are no alternatives, then it's hard to see that any projecting is going on in the first place. I mean, isn't that just to say that the thing is already there in reality? If there's no other way in which you can see reality, it's not logically possible to see reality in any other way, then I don't see in what sense you'd be making any kind of projection. What would the screen be? The screen would have to be something, some piece of reality which was the way it was in advance of the projection, in advance of the necessities being invested in it. But if there isn't any alternative way to put the necessities in than the way you do, then that seems to me tantamount to saying, well, they're there already, and you've just got to follow them. You've got to do what reality says, as it were. You don't have any choice in the matter. So it doesn't seem to me that projection in this case is an appropriate image. So the projectivist faces a dilemma. Either we take the image of projection seriously, in which case the whole transaction is contingent, and then we're back with the old version of conventionalism, which has to make sense of the possibility that 7 plus 5 might be 13. Or we say that the projection is ineluctable, there's no way of doing it differently, but then it seems that it's not really a projection at all. It seems that the realist, in effect, gives the right description of the scenario then, that there is necessity out there in reality. We're not actually projecting it as onto a screen, because if we really were, then the screen itself wouldn't already contain necessity. Or rather, if there's no alternative to making the projection that we make, if in effect we're forced to do it, logically forced to do it, then that means that it really is there. That's why we're logically forced to do it. So that the realist is in effect giving the correct description of the scenario. Okay, I'll leave that there.